This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, the 5th of August, 2008. From Pacifica Station KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. The Food and Drug Administration tries to clean up its image of being too close to the drug industry.
I don't think I'm being cynical to say that companies will, in fact, find ways around this.
We'll go to Portland, where citizens and lawmakers are trying to stop expansion of the interstate.
There were boats there with guns pointing at me. It is a risky thing, but I'm only one person risking my life, and we're risking hundreds of people's lives.
We'll hear how new mining laws in Colombia could affect small-scale miners there. And we'll check in on the International AIDS Conference in Mexico City and the call for a new national strategy for the United States. All that and more after this news.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines. U.S. officials say they've arrested a Pakistani scientist with alleged links to al-Qaeda after she spent several years on the FBI's list of most wanted terrorists. It's the same woman human rights groups suspect has been held for years in secret detention. From Manhattan, Renee Feltz reports.
Afia Siddiqui appeared in federal court today, where she was arraigned on charges of attempted murder and assault of U.S. officers in Afghanistan. Officials say she has links to alleged members of al-Qaeda held at Guantanamo Bay. Siddiqui was arrested last month by Afghan police. According to a federal complaint, when U.S. Army officers and FBI agents went to take custody of her, Siddiqui rushed out from behind a curtain and opened fire on them with an assault rifle that a U.S. Army warrant officer had left on the floor. Her lawyer disputes the charges. The only person wounded in the incident was Siddiqui, who was shot in the chest by a U.S. officer. Siddiqui left the United States in 2003 after studying at MIT and returned to Pakistan with her three children. Relatives say that shortly afterwards, she disappeared from her parents' home in Karachi. Pakistani human rights groups say she may have been held at Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan. At a news conference in Pakistan, Siddiqui's family said her arrest is a mockery. They argue she's been held in secret detention for the last 5 years. The Pakistan Human Rights Commission said the charges were fabricated and called for her to be tried by an independent tribunal. Pakistan has demanded consular access to Siddiqui. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Renee Feltz at the federal courthouse in Manhattan.
The state of Texas is set to execute a Mexican national tonight, despite a world court ruling that ordered the U.S. to stay the execution. The Mexican government is challenging the death sentences of around 50 of its citizens in the U.S., arguing that consular officials were not given proper access to the men until after they were already sentenced. The Vienna Convention on Consular Relations gives foreign detainees the right to seek legal assistance through their consulates upon arrest. The World Court in The Hague had ordered the U.S. to issue provisional stays in the capital cases to give the court time to make a final ruling on the challenge brought by the Mexican government. President Bush is in South Korea on a two-day official visit before traveling on to Beijing to attend the Olympics opening ceremony. His summit with Korean President Lee Myung-bak is expected to focus on the denuclearization talks with North Korea. However, protests against the import of American beef may overshadow Bush's trip. Jason Strother has more from Seoul.
It's the third time during the president's administration that he's paid a visit to South Korea. And like his previous trips, thousands of protesters have come out to jeer him. Riot police were dispatched today to control crowds protesting Seoul's recent decision to lift a 5-year-long ban on American beef imports. Authorities used water cannons to disperse the crowds, and police took at least 12 demonstrators into custody. Anti-Bush protesters also scuffled with pro-American groups, who held a prayer vigil today for the improvement of U.S.-South Korean relations. On Wednesday, Presidents Bush and Lee will hold their third summit since the South Korean leader took office in February. The verification of North Korea's nuclear weapons program is expected to be high on their agenda. This is most likely Bush's final official trip to Asia before his term in office expires in January. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jason Strother in Seoul, South Korea.
The government of Kosovo has appointed its first defense minister. The position will oversee the formation of the Kosovo Security Force to be trained by NATO. Alexandra Spasov has more.
Former Kosovo guerrilla fighter Fehmi Mujota was named defense minister of newly independent state of Kosovo earlier today. Mujota will lead the effort to establish a 2,500-strong Kosovo security force as part of former province blueprint for internationally supervised independence. 16,000 NATO peacekeepers will remain in charge of security in Kosovo in the meantime. A European Union-led mission will take over judicial and law enforcement duties in Kosovo in October. Local Serbs in northern Kosovo openly oppose the EU mission unless it comes with approval from the UN Security Council. Kosovo's ethnic Albanian majority declared independence in February. The Republic of Kosovo has since been recognized by 43 countries, including the US and most EU member states. Kosovo began issuing passports a few days ago. Some states, like Macedonia and Montenegro, which have not officially recognized the independent Kosovo, say they will let Kosovo citizens enter their territory with the new passports, while Bosnia and Slovakia will not accept documents. For FSRN, I'm Aleksandra Spasov in Belgrade.
A new municipal ordinance in Los Angeles has outlawed the practice of dropping off indigent hospital patients on the city streets, a practice otherwise known as patient dumping. Maciel Bobadilla reports from L.A.
The new ordinance makes it a misdemeanor for hospitals and clinics to leave patients anywhere but their places of residence without written consent. The ordinance came in response to several instances of LA area hospital workers abandoning homeless patients on downtown Skid Row. More than 50 allegations of so-called homeless dumping are currently under investigation by the Office of LA City Attorney Rocky Delgadillo. Health facilities face fines of up to $1,000 per violation if convicted. Hospital officials say convictions under the ordinance put their facilities at risk of losing funding from federal health programs, such as Medicare, Medi-Cal, and Medicaid. The Hospital Association of Southern California strongly opposes the new ordinance, maintaining that the area's health facilities are already overcrowded with an estimated 18,000 homeless patients seeking treatment every year. For FSRN, I'm Maciel Bobadilla in Los Angeles.
And those are the headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
The Food and Drug Administration is taking new steps to fight charges that the agency has become too cozy with the drug industry. It's now issued new guidelines barring experts from sitting on FDA advisory boards if they have a financial conflict of interest exceeding $50,000. But will the new standards actually keep people safer? FSRN's Tanya Snyder has more.
When genetically modified organisms were approved by the FDA, the head of policy was a man named Michael Taylor. Taylor had been the attorney for Monsanto, the biotech giant that produces genetically modified seeds. After a successful stint at the FDA, Taylor returned to Monsanto as their vice president. But while at the FDA, Taylor determined that safety testing and labeling of GMOs was unnecessary, despite FDA staff conclusions to the contrary. Jeffrey Smith is the author of Seeds of Deception and Genetic Roulette.
When the policy came out, it was in exact opposition to the scientific recommendations at the agency, entirely determined by the political appointees who came from Monsanto, went back to Monsanto, and Monsanto was the company that benefited the most from that lax regulation.
Smith says industry officials have even ended up in FDA positions where they evaluate their own research. The new FDA standards on conflict of interest don't address this revolving door between the agency and industry. The guidelines bar experts from serving on FDA advisory committees if they have received more than $50,000 from the company they're reviewing in the past year. The new guidelines address the problem that was revealed in 2005 when an FDA advisory panel voted to put Vioxx back on the market, despite the company's own concerns about the risk of heart attack and stroke. At the same time, the committee decided that a similar drug, Pfizer's Bextra, could remain on the market. 10 out of the 32 board members had financial ties to the drug companies, and their votes swung the committee's decision. The FDA ended up disregarding the committee's recommendation. Jeffrey Smith says the new guidelines' limitations only on financial interest within the past year leaves a loophole.
It's easy for corporations to work within a $50,000 limit. Simply by offsetting payments by year, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't think I'm being cynical to say that companies will, in fact, find ways around this.
The guidelines still allow for waivers for committee members who have a financial interest as long as it's under $50,000. And the new guidelines would still allow someone like Michael Taylor to float back and forth between the agency and industry, Scott Amey, general counsel of the Project on Government Oversight, says that may be the biggest problem.
You're hoping that these people are coming into the government with the public's interest in mind and not their own or not their industry or their private sector employer. And that's a real problem with these advisory committees, is making sure that they put the general public's interest first.
One FDA official defended the occasional overlap between industry and the FDA, saying that if a committee is reviewing a specialized medical device, it's important to have on the committee the people who know the most about it, and those may be people who conducted reviews of that or a similar product for the industry. He said the FDA could choose not to seek input from the foremost authorities in their field, or the agency can let the public benefit from their knowledge and advice. For FSRN, I'm Tanya Snyder in Washington.
Reports have surfaced that Walmart is intimidating employees into voting against Barack Obama. Store and department managers are forced to attend mandatory meetings where they're told that a vote for Barack Obama would be a vote for unions, which would mean a vote for job loss. Retail giant Walmart has long associated the formation of unions as bad for its bottom line. Democrat Barack Obama supports a bill in Congress that proponents say would make it easier for workers to organize. My colleague Leanne Caldwell spoke with Lance Compa, labor law professor at Cornell University.
What is it about this bill that Walmart and other employers might not like?
I think the employers, including Walmart and others, are most exercised about this law because it means that they can't, I mean, they still can, but it wouldn't have the same effect. To haul workers into what are called captive audience meetings, where managers and often outside consultants that specialize in this kind of anti-union campaigning come in and just harangue workers about the dangers of organizing, and they suggest that if a union comes in, the plant might close, or if the union comes in, wages and benefits might get worse, and so on.
The fact that Walmart is holding meetings about the elections, some are saying intimidating its employees to vote a certain way, is that not illegal right now?
If I understand it correctly, they're not doing that with rank-and-file hourly employees, which would clearly be illegal, I think. They are doing it with management employees, and it's probably legal in terms of top-level policy-making managers, that sort of thing. The problem is that Walmart has multiple layers of people they classify as supervisors who are not all that high up in the hierarchy and who really face a lot of the same conditions as the hourly workers. If they're calling those people into the meetings, and I think they are, from the reports I've read, I think they are, I think that does cross the line into, you know, I mean, it's not for me to say because, you know, I'm not a judge. There would have to be a case brought. But I think that employees in a situation like that, low-level supervisors, would feel terrible pressure to vote the way Walmart tells them because they, you know, they're unprotected. They feel like they have to do what Walmart says, or if Walmart finds out how they voted, and if, you know, if Walmart says vote for McCain in an area where Obama wins, and say Obama wins that congressional district or that town or something, then the supervisors might fear that, well, Obama won here, so maybe they think I voted for Obama. You know, whether she did or not, it doesn't matter. I think it does have an intimidating effect to pull people into meetings like that and try to tell them how to vote.
Is voter intimidation in the workplace common? Is this something that we have seen before?
Well, the anti-union intimidation that I talked about earlier is standard operating procedure whenever workers try to form a union, with some exceptions. As I said, there are some companies and unions that sit down and they negotiate a procedure for workers to choose whether or not to have a collective bargaining relationship without that kind of pressure. This latest event of mandatory meetings for employees for the company to talk about the upcoming presidential elections, they say we're not telling people how to vote, but they're obviously telling people how Walmart wants them to vote. That's quite unusual. I think that's there may be cases of that in small workplaces, but this is the first I've heard of it on the scale of Walmart. I mean, nobody's on the scale of Walmart since it's the biggest private employer in the country, so I suppose we jump right to there. But this is very unusual, and I think a very dangerous development. If it becomes widespread, then working people will feel tremendous pressure from their employers, a political threat, in effect, that you're going to suffer terrible consequences if you vote a certain way. And I think that crosses a line that we haven't seen before in American political discourse.
Lance Compa, thank you so much. Labor law professor from Cornell University. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
That was Leanne Caldwell speaking with Lance Compa, labor law professor at Cornell University. You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. FSRN has brought you uncensored news from the U.S. and around the world every day for more than 7 years. We're proud of our history of challenging old models of media access and control by highlighting the voices of marginalized communities most affected by social and economic policy changes. Now, a large funding cut and economic hard times jeopardize our ability to continue producing a daily newscast. You can visit us online at fsrn.org to find out more about how you can help keep us on the air. That's fsrn.org. In the years since the Interstate 35 bridge collapse in Minneapolis, cities around the nation have been scrambling to restore and replace aging transportation infrastructure. In 1955, the national highway system carried some 65 million cars and trucks. Today, that number has nearly quadrupled to 246 million. At a time when the highway system is badly in need of repair, some places, like Portland, Oregon, have started to debate whether highway infrastructure should be expanded at all in light of the looming climate crisis. FSRN's Jenka Soderberg has more.
Commuters headed from downtown Portland to area highways on Monday afternoon were greeted by two activists dangling from a bridge on 50-foot ropes, holding a banner reading "Six more lanes equals more sick people. No I-5 bridge expansion." The six lanes refer to a proposal to replace the existing Interstate 5 bridge from Portland to Vancouver, Washington, with a larger, expanded multi-lane bridge. Maya was one of the banner hangers.
I knew that the police were going to be there, but I had my support to make sure that I was going to be safe, though there were boats there with guns pointing at me. It is a risky thing, but I'm only one person risking my life, and we're risking hundreds of people's lives by extending that bridge. I would prefer to risk my single life than have that bridge expanded.
Oregon and Washington officials estimate that a new bridge over the Columbia River will cost roughly $4 billion. Nationally, the American Society of Civil Engineers estimates that it would take more than $1.5 trillion over a five-year period to upgrade crumbling infrastructure, including highways, bridges, railways, and levees. Many cities and towns have turned to private, often foreign investors, to pay for and run their highways and bridges, while the federal government prioritizes military and so-called economic stimulus spending. At the same time, more and more people are waking up to the reality of climate change and the finite world supply of fossil fuels. The city of Portland is considered progressive in its land use and city planning policies, with the Region 2040 program designed to create livable communities accessible by public transportation. But environmentalists point out that with the immensity of the climate crisis, the plan will be insufficient as long as it includes projects like the I-5 bridge replacement. Mara Gross is with the Coalition for a Livable Future.
One thing that I'm really concerned about is how this project will affect global warming. We have very ambitious goals for global warming in Oregon that were established by the legislature last year, and it's not at all clear how this project is going to impact that. And the information we've seen so far is concerning. It's showing that driving will increase by 40% under this proposal when we need to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 75% over 1990 levels by 2050.
For some, the concerns are even more personal. Speaking at a rally opposing the highway expansion, local resident Sylvia Evans talked about the connection between highway expansion and asthma rates, which she has experienced personally since moving to a house located within 500 yards of the highway.
6 months after moving into the Plaza townhomes, my oldest daughter had her first asthma attack. I spent many hours in the hospital wondering, where did this come from? How did this happen? By the time my third child came around, I knew that something wasn't just wrong with my housing, but there was something wrong with my community. As I saw more and more of my neighbors come down with congestive heart failure, cancer, asthma, upper and lower respiratory conditions. What I'm asking is that instead of trying to transport people from one state to another, that you pay attention to what they're going through. They're going through our homes, our neighborhoods, and we have the right to live in a healthy, safe environment where we can all live, work, and play, and raise our families.
a number of local groups have proposed alternatives to the expansion of Interstate 5 in Portland. At a debate on the issue 2 weeks ago, Portland economist Joe Cartwright argued for the repair of the existing bridge instead of the expansion plan.
We think there are really viable alternatives to spending $4 billion. For a much reduced level of money, we could fix the existing bridge and do that in a way that would seriously deal with the congestion problem that we face. Now, when you think about how to spend $4 billion, it's a lot of money. And the question I would ask is this. If you had $4 billion on this podium today, and you could spend it in any way to improve the quality of life in our region, how would you spend it? Would you put all of it in this bridge?
The alternative plan to expanding the I-5 bridge, proposed by a coalition of 13 environmental groups, includes fixing a parallel railroad bridge and expanding public transit. They estimate it will cost around $200 million, as opposed to $4 billion for the proposed new bridge. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jenka Soderberg at KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon.
The Centers for Disease Control released a report indicating that the number of new people infected by HIV in the United States is much higher than previously estimated, 40% higher. Previous figures estimated new infections at 40,000 per year. Now the CDC says the number of new cases of HIV infection is closer to 56,000 per year. The CDC says the new data suggests a stable epidemic, but that the numbers are still unacceptably high, with a steady increase in infection rates among gay and bisexual men. California Representative Barbara Lee is attending the International AIDS Conference taking place in Mexico City this week. At a time when new cases of HIV are higher than previously estimated, Lee is calling for a new national AIDS strategy in the United States.
Very important for U.S. officials to participate in these conferences because we learn a lot from the world community about how to stamp this pandemic from the face of the earth. One of the very important aspects of this is to talk about the AIDS pandemic in the United States, our domestic crisis, and why it's important we have a national AIDS strategy and put together our own initiative so that we can, stamp HIV and AIDS from the face of the United States. It's very critical that we see this as a global pandemic. It's affecting, of course, sub-Saharan Africa and the Caribbean in disproportionate numbers, but also the African-American community and African-American women in the Latino community. The numbers are growing, and so we have to have a strategy for our own country. It's not either or, it's both and so I'm here to try to make sure that that happens.
Representative Lee wants to organize an international AIDS conference in the United States and is calling for increased resources to target the pandemic in those communities most affected by HIV and AIDS in the U.S. Some HIV/AIDS activists want to use the presidential and congressional campaign season to encourage candidates to seriously address the AIDS pandemic. Paul Zeitz works with the Global AIDS Alliance Fund, a Washington-based advocacy group.
The Global AIDS Alliance Fund recently launched a new initiative to call on all candidates for Congress, both House members and Senate seats, to sign a pledge. And we're working with AIDS Action Council to mobilize all races in the United States to sign the Congressional Pledge, which calls on candidates for Congress to commit to the U.S. national strategy to combat AIDS and to fully fund the PEPFAR bill, the $48 billion bill that President Bush signed last week, and also to commit to create a new U.S. Cabinet Department on Global Development. So we hope all of you will join our efforts to get candidates for Congress to sign the Congressional Pledge. Go to www.globalaidsalliancefund.org to find out all the details.
The International AIDS Conference continues in Mexico City through the end of the week. Disputes between multinational mining companies and small-scale miners are worsening in Colombia and may lead to the displacement of hundreds of residents from their homes. Small-scale miners fear that new mining laws that encourage foreign investment could make a bad situation even worse. FSRN's Manuel Rueda has more from Bogotá.
Jose Moreno Gonzalez Mayo.
A dozen Americans are holding a protest in front of Colombia's presidential palace. They're reading out the names of civilians who have died at the hands of the Colombian army. Tina Bush Nima just came back from the forests of southern Bolivar province. She volunteers for the Christian Peacemaker Teams, a human rights group that recently visited peasants and small mining communities.
One woman told me how both of her brothers were killed by the paramilitary, and one of her brothers was chopped up bit by bit. And I met with her mother then, and both of us cried because I have a son. And I thought, if I lost my son in such a brutal manner, it would carve a hole in my heart that I don't think I could ever stop.
Over 100,000 Colombians have fled their homes this year, and southern Bolivar is one of the hottest conflict zones. This region is rich in gold reserves, and its mountains shelter drug traffickers, guerrillas, and paramilitary groups. The government says it's trying to clear the area of these bandits, but the local miners see things differently. Teófilo Acuña lived in southern Bolivar most of his life, but last year he was forced to flee to Bogotá. As the president of the Agro-Mining Federation, he lobbied the government to support hundreds of local gold miners and to grant them titles to their small holdings.
We received a death threat via email, where the paramilitaries said they were going to kill us because we did not agree with the government security policies, because we were against multinationals, and because we did not let the army participate in community meetings.
Acuña says that the paramilitaries constantly threaten the lives of peasants and small miners, and that the army turns a blind eye. He also says they confiscate mining supplies like fire powder and gasoline, claiming that these goods are going to guerrilla groups. For Acuña, this is all part of a plan to force people to leave their lands, paving the way for multinationals. Multinational corporations like Chevron and Glencore are exploiting oil, coal, and gold in several parts of Colombia. In southern Bolivar, Anglo Gold Ashanti is already prospecting for gold, and it plans to establish large mines in the area. Local authorities have not charged this company with forcing people off their lands, but Senator Jorge Robledo says that there are other ways for companies to take over resources.
Hoy la norma lo que dice es primero en el tiempo, primero en el derecho.
They're going to take the best areas in the country, and in order to get the title, you will have to demonstrate that you have the economic and technical capabilities that will make the mine a good deal for the state. The selection criteria will be based on how much money you have and not how long you've been there.
The government says that these measures are needed to encourage foreign investment, and it claims that large operators can exploit Colombia's natural resources at a greater rate. But Acuña says he will continue to fight for small mines, run by the local population. If we exploit the mines, the mountains will last longer, he says, and most of the profits will stay at home. Manuel Rueda, FSRN, Bogotá.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. Special thanks today to AIDS2008.com. From Pacifica Station KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado.